When China Mieville's first novel, King Rat, was published in 1998, readers weren't prepared for what was to come. This surreal junglist manifesto brought a drum and bass beat to the world of London-loving magic realism. But when Perdido Street Station was published, the real lit quake began. In a novel boiling with invention and grotesquerie, readers found prose so musical, so dense, that it defied the very imaginations it set afire. His following novel, a standalone sequel set in the world of Boz Log, The Scar, mapped an inner landscape every bit as challenging as the outer landscape and was nominated for a Hugo and World Fantasy Award. His latest novel is Iron Council, and it returns to the world of Boz Log with a tale of overt politics, war without reason, and the power of any single human being. It's no surprise that political machinations are a central theme in Iron Council. Mieville has a Ph.D. in international relations, made a bid for parliament in 2001, running for MP of his district with the Socialist Alliance Party, and was a featured speaker at the Marxism 2003 conference. Welcome to Fine Print, China.
Thanks very much for having me on.
China, tell us a little bit about your origins as a writer. What brought you to write fiction and fantasy fiction in particular?
It's pretty much the same story you hear from most writers of science fiction, fantasy, and horror. I like to write what I grew up reading and the kind of books that I love to read. As a kid, I mostly read speculative fiction in all its various forms. And as I got older, I kind of branched out as a reader and read much more widely as well as just the genre. But as a writer, I was never able to sustain interest in something that didn't have monsters in it. So I'm in this business for the monsters. I write books that have the kind of grotesquerie and strangeness and the weird, which was what kind of got me interested in this field in the first place. I knew I wanted to do this since I was, certainly sort of 12, 13, and just, wrote short stories and then finally wrote my first novel when I was in my early 20s, and it kind of snowballed from there.
Tell us a little bit about King Rat.
Well, King Rat, my first book, was written very much of its time. I mean, in London in the early to mid-90s, there was this musical phenomenon, drum and bass, jungle music, which was extremely important and popular, and was a kind of homegrown London British dance music, and it was something that had quite a big cultural impact, and I was really interested in it, and I wanted to write a novel that kind of took it seriously as an art form, that music. But that was also the kind of supernatural thriller that I like to read. And so it kind of developed from there. King Rat himself, who's one of the main characters of the book, who's kind of an animal spirit, was a character from children's pantomimes and plays that I'd seen when I was a little tiny kid, a kind of comic villain. But he'd really terrified me. He'd been something I'd been really kind of freaked out by and had never kind of left my head. And I'd always drawn comics involving him and so on. And so I just ended up sort of focusing on him. And he was a minor character in the first, when I first started writing it, but he kind of grew and grew and grew to take over the book.
Another major character in that book is the city of London itself.
Mm.
Tell us about your love of the urban, the dense, the dank, the unky urban.
Well, London's one of those cities which for some reason refracts very, very well through fiction. And there's a whole tradition of like London fiction and, Michael Moorcock and Dickens and Ian Sinclair and Thomas De Quincey and Neil Gaiman. I mean, there's a very long list of writers who write a kind of underground London. For some reason, that kind of fictional representation of London is very, very intense. And I see the two strands that I wanted to do with King Rat was, one was the music and one was London. And I really wanted to write a classic London novel, just a novel that treated London very, very seriously, not just as a setting, but as a kind of, as a character. I can't really take credit for doing anything radically new there. I mean, I'm glad it. I hope it went well, and I was really pleased with it. But as I say, there is quite a tradition of treating London that way. It's just a fascinating city because its size, the way it sprawls, its history, the way history butts up right close to really new things. It's, well, I'm a big fan.
Well, your history of this novel also butts up close to all these other London novels. When you started writing this novel, did you have those novels in mind? Did you think about those? Had you recently read them?
Some of them. I mean, I'd always been interested in that tradition of writing. I mean, Ian Sinclair is a British writer who, you know, is very important in my fiction. There's a book called The Borribles by a British writer, Michael de Larabiti, a children's book, but a very dark children's book, which has the same kind of dissident relationship to London, I suppose. And I was conscious of all of these as kind of the shoulders on which I was standing, so I hope it doesn't end up becoming pastiche, but I was certainly very conscious of writing as part of a sort of tradition, yeah.
The city of London also pops up in a transfigured manner in Perdido Street Station, doesn't it?
Yeah, the city of New Crobuzon, which is the setting of Perdido Street Station, is very much a kind of, as you say, a sort of transmogrified London. You know, it's Dickens's London, messed about with and put through the mill and ground up and smudged with oil and all that kind of things. But I mean, it's not the only city there. I mean, New Crobuzon is a composite of lots of cities that I'm a big fan of. So the largest part obviously is London, but there's also, it has New York in it, it has Havana in it, it has Cairo in it, it has any city I go to that I'm interested in, I just steal something from.
Tell us a little bit about your love of monsters.
Well, there's not much to tell, really. I mean, it's Tolkien apparently once said that he wrote The Lord of the Rings because what he really wanted to do was invent an elvish language, but that publishers wouldn't publish an elvish language, so he had to write this pesky novel in which to sort of smuggle the language. And sometimes I feel a bit like that about monsters. You know, my big draw is the monsters. I just like bestiaries. I like collections of weird invented creatures, but I'm not going to get that published, so I kind of put them into a story. One of the paradoxes about as New Crobuzon and the New Crobuzon books, you know, they've done well and people have been really nice, you know, kind about them and I've got great good reviews and so on, is that there is in fact increasing interest in just the idea of just a bestiary or the encyclopedia. So one of these days I fully intend to, you know, write and illustrate the Baslag bestiary, which would just be an excuse for me to just, you know, really let rip on all the monsters I've been thinking about for years. Monster movies from the, you know, classic 40s and 50s B movies through to, you know, modern stuff, monster manuals from things like Dungeons and Dragons, medieval bestiaries. I just really groove on monsters, and I always have.
One of the things I like about your monsters is they aren't just objects of horror that are man-eating machines. They're characters.
Well, I mean, some are characters, some are animals, but not animals in the sense of incomprehensible vehicles for evil. I mean, literally animals, like a lion is an animal. I don't want the monstrous in my world is not a synonym for kind of unfathomable evil at all. The grotesquerie is what I'm interested in. I'm not interested in the moralizing that sometimes goes along with monsters, you know, the evil dragon and the good prince. I'm not particularly interested in that. So in the book, in all the books, you know, some of the monsters are, as you say, they're characters who we can get inside their heads. Other monsters have completely opaque motivations. I'm thinking about the Weaver, which is a kind of giant spider, a sort of philosophical surrealist giant spider. You can't possibly get inside its head, but that doesn't mean it's evil. And then some of them are animals, like the slake moths from the first of the series, Perdido Street Station. They do a huge amount of damage, but they're not evil. They're not devils. They they're just predatory animals, because I want to kind of, as I say, get away from this kind of moralistic notion that the monster is a kind of symbol for, you know, all that is bad, because that kind of moralism just doesn't interest me.
Your novels include a lot of scenes that are not just filled with monsters, but are also surreal. I'd like you to talk about your sense of the surreal and the grotesque and how you evoke that with your language.
There are various different traditions in fantastic literature and fantastic art, and the traditions that I've always been most interested in are, as you say, those of surrealism, decadence, the Baroque, the Gothic, rather than those of the kind of Victorian fairy tale. You know, if I like fairy tales, I tend to like, you know, the older versions of the fairy tales, which are somewhat more bloody. That kind of, as I say, that kind of Baroque surreal thing seems to me most interesting because it's the most genuinely fantastic, in the sense that it does not obey any rules. It, at its best, kind of defeats cliche. It's a kind of constant process of sort of radical alienation, and creates a kind of constant aesthetic culture shock in the reader or the viewer. And I'm really interested in that. And one of the ways I like to try and sort of explore that is through the language as well as through the story. That sometimes people, writers, think of language as essentially a kind of clear pane of glass through which you see the story. And, you know, there's some great work done on that basis. But it can also, at its worst, become a rather kind of plodding relationship to language itself. I'm more interested in the idea of language not as a clear pane of glass, but as, you know, like a stained glass window. So there's something behind it, and there's also the medium itself, which is also hopefully trying to do something to the reader. I'm interested in, at the high end, kind of literary experimentation, and at the low end, I mean, I use these terms in inverted commas, at the low end, the sort of kind of pulp poetry of someone like H.P. Lovecraft, who uses language with a kind of incredible, rich, overwrought sort of focus on the sounds of words, the cadence of words, sometimes almost unreadable, but always very interesting in terms of the language he's using. And I just like sort of trying to take the language seriously as more than just a medium for the content, but as an end in itself. The cadence of words, the structure of sentences, the way sentences relate to each other, all that kind of thing. You always run the risk of becoming obscurantist and, you know, putting people off and being difficult. But at the same time, I think in the long run, it's more interesting than a kind of constant literal expositionary style, if you like.
Now, you talked about creating a sort of cultural shockwave in the reader, and you do that very successfully.
Well, thank you.
I'd like to know is, as you're writing, have you already mapped out the world and the grotesquerie that you create with this language? How much of a part does the language play in the creation of the world itself?
I do tend to map the world quite vigorously and rigorously before I write the story. I mean, it tends to be a story set in a world I've been inventing, rather than the invention of the world through the story. And there are exceptions to that, and there are times when I change the parameters as I'm doing the writing. But as I say, what I'm very interested in is culture shock. I'm very interested in trying to create that sense of culture shock in the reader. I want to try and create a sense as if the reader has got on the wrong aeroplane and gets off in an airport that they're not expecting, and just spend some time just really not being able to make sense of it, but, you know, being kind of assaulted by all these images and so on. And I think part of the best way to do that is to have quite a strong sense of the world, but then not to explain it. So in most cases, I know what's going on, but it would be almost kind of too plodding to actually just explain to the reader what's going on. that technique for kind of pointing at stuff that's just beyond the page, but then not actually bringing it into the page, from buildings to history to creatures to anything, I think can be quite a successful technique for that kind of culture shock. And you can also do that with the language. Like, I use a lot of neologisms. I use a lot of words that I invent, which are generally intended to sound half familiar. So I use words that, you know, have some relationship to real language. They're not just completely random sets of consonants and vowels, but which are like twisted enough that you kind of half recognize them. That's the attempt to create a sort of culture shock that brings you in but pushes you away at the same time.
You're very successful with your neologisms.
Oh, thank you very much.
They're beautiful. And that brings to mind another point, that one of the pleasures of reading your books is that you managed to make all the words pronounceable.
Well, most of them. I mean, I don't promise I'll always do that, but I mean, generally, you know, the creatures and the aliens in my world and the alien cultures are all people I want the reader to be able to get inside their head. So it's difficult to empathize with someone whose name is unsayable.
Could you talk a little bit about the plotting in your fantasies? Fantasies have a structure, or we've come to expect a certain kind of structure from fantasies, and we don't find it in yours.
When I wrote Perdido Street Station, it was as much to do with the setting as it was to do with anything else. And the plot is a tremendously simple plot in Perdido Street Station. The plot is just, you know, monsters run riot. It's what in the film Aliens they call a bug hunt. You know, it's just, you know, monsters chase, catch, find. Very, very simple plot, because the main point was the setting in some ways. With The Scar, that changed a lot, because, as you say, there is a certain traditional fantasy plot shape, narrative arc, which is basically, you know, the quest fantasy, the, you know, looking for the magical object or so on. And of course, there's plenty of fantasy that doesn't have that shape, but that tends to be the cliche. And what I wanted to do with The Scar was to have something which pretended to have that shape, but then constantly undermined itself. So it looks at first glance, I think, like a quest fantasy. It is, you know, there is something very, very far away that people are, you know, trying very hard to get to and, you know, to reach because lots of magic and so on, crudely. But that in the development of the plot, it undercuts itself as much as it offers it out. So that was a book in which I was very, very conscious of the plotting and of the sense of, you know, the shape of the narrative, and trying to have something which had its own integrity, but also which referred to the classic shape of fantasy with a kind of somewhat critical eye. And then in Iron Council, again, in certain ways, Iron Council is quite a traditional plot. I mean, in certain ways, Iron Council is there and back again, like The Hobbit, you know, I mean, in certain ways. But hopefully, I mean, I won't go into detail because it would give things away, but hopefully it has a certain sort of skewed enough take that it doesn't read as tremendously cliched, you know.
Let's talk about the classics, since you brought them up. The typical fantasy classic is considered to be Tolkien, but to my mind, you don't take after Tolkien very much.
No, well, I mean, I've talked quite a lot about Tolkien in various interviews and so on, and I, you know, I mean, my thoughts on his work is kind of on record. I mean, basically, I'm not a huge fan of Tolkien. I find his work, I don't like his use of language, which I find sort of at best kind of faux epic, and at worst a kind of very kind of plodding sort of fairy tale, kind of faux fairy tale register. I'm not a big fan of his moralism. I don't find his characters convincing. You know, all of which said, there are certain things that Tolkien did very, very importantly, and the most important one for me was treating the secondary world that he invented with a kind of, you know, absolute precise respect and taking that project of world creation very seriously. And I think anyone who works in fantasy has to acknowledge that we're all Tolkien's children, whether we like it or not. And I also think that there's a danger in kind of cheap radical chic in just kind of, you know, running around dissing Tolkien all the time. And I've done my Tolkien dissing. So anyone who wants to, you know, read all my Tolkien dissing, it's all online. But I feel it's just getting a bit sort of undignified and disrespectful now. Certainly in terms of influences, I feel more directly influenced by writers like Mervyn Peake.
Sure. Gormenghast is beautiful.
Gormenghast and you know, writers who precede Tolkien, like Fritz Lieber, and obviously the weird tales writers like Clark Ashton Smith and H.P. Lovecraft, that kind of very baroque, fantastic world. And even in a funny way, you know, the Conan stories have a kind of, I mean, not that there are many, many problems with the Conan stories, but they have a kind of sort of a sort of muscular vigor that I find lacking in Tolkien. Similarly with certain kind of Edgar Rice Burroughs. So yes, Tolkien is someone who you can't avoid in fantasy, and you might as well just acknowledge that and try and, you know, deal with that gracefully. But he's not by any means a huge direct influence on me, I don't think.
I want to talk to you a bit about the politics of genre fiction. There's lots of literary genres and subgenres, and speculative fiction seems to be good at popping up subgenres and bringing them forth as if they shall conquer all.
You know, there's always these waves of movements and moments and all this, and, you know, science fiction, speculative fiction, whatever you want to call it, SF, fantasy, horror, has essentially a kind of a relationship to mainstream literary fiction, in inverted commas, of kind of, I think, sort of disgruntled inferiority. I mean, you know, we don't get, on the whole, we don't win the literary prizes. We don't get taken tremendously seriously by literary editors and so on. Having said all of which, you know, science fiction is that's a complaint we've had for years and years and years. I kind of think to some extent we should shut up about it. Not that it's not true and not that it's not annoying, but we all know, so let's move on. And also, certainly in Britain, and my sense is perhaps here, it's not so true anymore. I mean, no, science fiction writers aren't winning the Booker Prize, but they are getting reviewed in the mainstream papers much more than they used to. They're getting reviewed on the radio. They're getting interviewed on the radio, you know. So, I mean, I for example, have absolutely no complaints about how many reviews and the way I've been reviewed in the mainstream press in Britain or the States. And although, of course, there are those people that are going to denigrate genre fiction, I think our best response is to just sort of, continue to write the best fiction we can. Quite often when science fiction people are talking about a kind of defending the genre, they refer to Sturgeon's Law from, you know, Theodore Sturgeon, which is, you know, yes, 90% of science fiction is crap, but 90% of everything is crap, as a way of sort of saying the denigration of SF is unfair. And I always think that that's true, but we also need to turn it back round and say, you know, what we're forgetting is that just because 90% of everything is rubbish doesn't mean that it's okay that 90% of science fiction is rubbish. You know, 90% of what gets put out in our field is rubbish, and that's not good enough. And then, you know, as you say, there's all these kind of subgenres. There's the cyberpunk, and there's the new worlds, and so on, steampunk. I think movements are fun. I think they're interesting. I think they're fun. I like manifestos. I like, you know, literary debates. I like literary arguments. But I think you have to take it with a big pinch of salt, you know. And some of these movements mean a lot more to me than others. I feel very much like a child of the new wave, the science fiction writing of the early 70s. I don't feel so much like a child of cyberpunk, although I admire some of the writers very much. But, you know, these are always going to be, at best, fuzzy sets. There's going to be an awful lot of grey areas, you know, and if you take them more seriously than that, then you're not going to be able to make sense of what's being written.
Now, I'd like to take this back and talk more about your new novel, Iron Council. It's one of the most overtly political fantasy novels I've ever read, but then it's easy to forget that fantasy has always been a political genre from the get-go, from the Iliad and the Odyssey.
Particularly in the last 150 years, you know, the fantastic in general has often been turned to political uses. And you think of people like William Morris, and you think of, you know, Samuel Butler's Erewhon. And you can get into debates as to whether this is science fiction or fantasy, but the fantastic as a field, right back to Gulliver's Travels, in which the fantastic is used for socially, politically satirical purposes. There was a lot of politics embedded in Perdido Street Station and The Scar, and I wanted to write a book set in this world that I really love and I've spent a lot of time developing and inventing, that took those politics and extrapolated them out and tried to, you know, really kind of engage with them and tried to be, you know, as you say, a political fantasy novel. But I always say this to people, it's also very important that it's a novel. And if you're not interested in the politics, this book has, you know, I think, I hope, really, you know, really cool monsters, and it has, you know, gunfights, and it has, you know, war scenes, and it has, you know, exciting chases and all that stuff. I mean, it, you know, I come out of pulp fiction. I'm a modern pulp writer. And if there's not, you know, cliffhangers and exciting stuff to make people turn the pages, then it's a bad novel. But if you are interested, then I've tried to put a kind of political texture to the novel. And the narrative itself, as you say, to some extent, unlike the previous two novels, is a narrative about political events. And for anyone who is interested in my politics or the kind of politics I'm interested in, there's the examination of certain themes of grassroots history and exploitation and all that kind of stuff is in there. So I try to have my cake and eat it. I try to write, you know, good rip-roaring pulp fiction that is also investigating the kind of themes I'm interested in, which tend to be political themes.
You also have some wonderful characters in there. There's a great love triangle with and it's most unusual and also takes on some political overtones.
Yeah, I presume you're talking about sexuality.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's an interesting point of this novel, and I think it's so well handled because it doesn't jump up, it doesn't announce itself. It just happens as a result of the characters you've created.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, essentially one of the main characters in this book is gay, and he's gay partly because for the purposes of the novel I wanted him to have a very particular kind of intense relationship with another character who was male and who I wanted to be male, and so it was simply a very, you know, simple and easy way of doing that. But of course, once you do that, then you raise a lot of, you know, issues and issues of sexuality and issues of politics and so on. And so I was, you know, very sort of happy to try and deal with those. But I'm glad that you don't think it jumps out at you, because I don't want this to become an issue novel. You know, it's not a novel about homosexuality or homophobia. It's a novel which has a main character who is a gay man, and that's a different thing. I remember when The Scar was finished, I was quite pleased because few people said to me, oh, you know, it's really interesting that you've written, you know, the protagonist is a woman. And I was glad about that because I didn't want it to be a book, you know, about women. It was a book, the protagonist of which was a woman. And of course, that does raise certain issues, and I didn't want to shy away from those issues. But that it wasn't like a kind of, you know, a pamphlet on, you know, on these issues. It wasn't like a kind of manifesto. And similarly with this. So the sexuality issue is very important and recurs throughout the book in various different ways. But the book is not a kind of, you know, thinly veiled article on sexuality.
No, not at all. One of the things it is, though, in part, is a Western.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Now, tell me, did you do much reading, background reading on Westerns before you wrote this?
Yeah, I did, because I think it's really important if you're going to write a book that relates to a tradition of fiction, I think it's really important to, well, basically to show respect for that tradition. And the first way you show respect for it is by reading it and learning about it. One of the, parenthetically, one of the things that annoys me when mainstream writers write science fiction is quite often they do so without having read any of the genre. And I think of books like Paul Theroux's Ozone, which is, you know, not a good book. And part of the reason it's not a good book is because he's trying to write a science fiction novel while distancing himself from the genre, not knowing anything about it and not, you know, reading any of it. That was my impression anyway. So having decided that I wanted to write a Western, you know, a Gothic Western with gunslingers, bounty hunters, you know, men on horseback, wide open plains, you know, two-bit one sheriff towns, gamblers, all that stuff, I went and read quite a lot of Westerns, you know, particularly the two that feature in the book, that loom in the book, is from the traditional end. Zane Grey was very influential, his depiction of landscape in particular. And from the kind of revisionist end, Cormac McCarthy, you know, who's the way he relates his language to the Western sort of the sort of epic landscape is something that was very influential. So yeah, I mean, I loved Western films growing up, and so I was reading, you know, Frank Spearman and various other Western things. Yeah, I tried to steep myself in that tradition.
Now, as a writer, I want you to talk about actually your politics, because they really inform this. And I wanted to set up your background. You have a PhD in international relations. Tell us a little bit about your politics, and then we'll bring back into the writing.
Well, I'm a progressive. I'm a socialist, which is a word that, you know, people in the States often don't, you know, use about themselves, but although I know many who do. I'm on the left, and I've been politically active for some years, and so it informs my worldview and very much, and therefore informs my fiction very much. You know, I think there's a lot of misconceptions about what that would mean to be a socialist. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding and confusion, you know, that you know, people say go back to Russia or whatever. You know, I never had any truck for the Eastern Bloc Stalinism. I didn't then, I don't now, you know. I am not a fan of North Korea, you know. It's a different kind of politics, you know. But that kind of basically, you know, sort of politics that is, you know, very skeptical of capitalism and the sort of that way of organizing society is something that in various forms has been a big part of my life. For most of my life, I've been politically active for a long time.
And socialism actually has a fairly significant history, even in the United States,
which has
been smashed lately and erased.
Eugene Debs, you know, great hero, and I know a great number of American socialists and so on. So I'm not saying it's not there, but I'm saying, you know, quite often, I mean, what I tend to find happens in the U.S. quite a lot is people who don't necessarily come from a political tradition think, you know, if I say I'm a socialist, they think that's really, really strange or mad or whatever. And then when we actually discuss about what I think, they agree with me on most of it, you know. And I'm thinking, yeah, you're a socialist too. You just didn't know, you know.
Well, tell me, what do you think?
Oh, well, you know, it's all the things you would expect, you know. I mean, all the obvious issues of, you know, racism and homophobia and sexism and so on are, you know, issues of kind of oppression are, you know, very important to me and the people I work with. You know, we try and stand against those wherever we can. And we're, you know, we try and be very active in the movement that is called, you know, global justice, anti-capitalism, whatever, you know, the movement that really kicked off in Seattle in 1999, you know, we see as, you know, I see as a very, very important sort of corrective to the constant refrain that there is no alternative, and that, you know, the free market, the word free there, I think, should have inverted commas around it. The free market system is the only one we can have. And I think that the slogan, another world is possible, which is used a lot, is a is a wonderful slogan, because one of the things that distresses me about politics at the moment is that it's the kind of collapse of any sense of an alternative, you know, that and I think that was something that Thatcherism and Reaganism was very keen on, was stressing there is no alternative, as Thatcher once said. And I think what's been happening increasingly over the last few years is people are saying, well, we insist on there being an alternative. We will not accept this agenda. And obviously at the moment what that means is, you know, opposing the war, you know, and the occupation in Iraq. So this is something I've been, you know, like millions of other people, very kind of concerned about and involved with in the last year and so. But, you know, I mean, I could go on about this sort of thing for hours, but it's basically an insistence that there are alternative ways of organizing the world, and that rather than putting profit before all else, it would be nice to put people before all else for a change.
And putting people before all else comes out in your fiction as well. You talk about racism and sexism. In Boz Log, you have speciesism.
Yeah.
And you do that well. Could you talk about your fictional creation?
Well, one of the things that happens in a lot of fantasy, with plenty of honorable exceptions, but with a lot of fantasy, species is more or less a code for race in our world. So that you see it in like Star Wars, and you see it in Tolkien, and you see it in a lot of writing that, you know, in Star Wars, for example, in episode one, you know, in The Phantom Menace, I think, you know, the Trade Federation were to me were fairly thinly veiled Asians, in a way that I thought was really problematic. I had all sorts of issues with that. And the interesting thing about that depiction of species as race, Star Trek is another example where you have, you know, I don't know how they got away with the Ferengi. I really don't, because I would have thought, you know, the Anti-Defamation League would have been onto them. But anyway, that's a whole other issue. I think the problem with that depiction is that in a lot of those worlds, race becomes defining. So that, you know, in a lot of traditional fantasy and science fiction, if you are of a certain race, you know, you really do have a certain set of behavioral, you know, patterns, and you really are a certain type of person. I mean, to put it crudely, in Middle Earth, orcs are they really are bad, you know, and elves, you know, they may be quite arrogant, but they really are on the whole good, you know. One of the problems with that is that this is a world in which racism is true. You know, the whole point of racism is that you say people of a certain race are like this. This is what they are. And in these fantasy and science fiction worlds, that's true. They really are like that. And that, to me, is very problematic, because it kind of accepts the logic of racism. What I wanted to do in Bas Lag was to say racism is real, but it's real just like it is in the real world, which is that it's real, but it's full of crap. And so in my world, I depict these races with lots of kind of cultural differences and so on, and there's a lot of oppression and a lot of prejudice against these races, but that's exactly what it is. It's oppression and prejudice, not a kind of logical response to real differences on the whole. And that was quite important to me. So I like to try and, you know, investigate racism as a social phenomenon rather than race as a social phenomenon.
One of the other things that I thought was absolutely fascinating in Iron Council was the way you discuss and portray the politics of change. And you portray it through a series of levels I found really interesting. There is change by artists, which you have as the flexible puppet theater, bringing back those terrifying puppet theaters of your youth. You have change by reasoned discourse, which is the Runagate Rampant set. You have change by underground violent revolution, which often comes as a result of personal motivations. You have change by war and invasion. You have change by dictatorship. And, of course, our favorite, always present, change by entropy. Could you tell us about how you set that up and how you can brought about those levels in the novel?
Well, I mean, of course, the thing is that there's no hard and fast distinctions between those levels. So, a radical group, for example, you know, may be motivated partly by reasoned discourse, partly by personal motives of revenge, and partly by the entropy of an organization that has always existed to this end, so doesn't have anything else to do. You know, I mean, there's all these gray areas. And for me, in a way, the most interesting thing is, you know, change at a kind of societal level, at a grand level, change which is a result of contradictions that were always embedded in a seemingly total whole. In fact, it was kind of eating itself apart with contradictions in its very middle, and that eventually those contradictions and those kind of tensions and so on will kind of spill over into a change at a kind of societal level. And what I'm looking at with all those different levels that you're talking about is almost more like snapshots at that overall phenomenon at various places in the social chain, if you like. So I see them as much more related than sort of distinct phenomena. But that, you know, I'm kind of choosing to focus in on one at a time. So, for example, you talk about artists. The change in the puppet theatres in the book that you're talking about is, to me, very much, you know, a result of and part of the same process of the upheaval that you see in some of the radical newspapers, which is itself very much part of the upheaval that you see in the actions of all the citizens on the ground. So they are more related, but I'm just kind of taking a look at different parts.
It's like a core sample.
Yeah, that's a nice metaphor.
Could you talk a little bit about the politics of art, both in your own art and in the art that is in your books?
Well, I get very anxious at the idea of art as a kind of direct political tool. I think that's a really bad idea. And I think the best artists, and ironically the best, well, not ironically, but, you know, the best political artists have known that. So the best political artists, are often people like, the French surrealist Benjamin Perret, who, you know, had no truck for the kind of finger wagging, you know, sort of agitprop approach to political art. I think that we have to kind of have a broader conception of political art than something which is really kind of simply and obviously about political themes. You know, surrealism for me, you look at a picture, it may look like a representation of a dream, but it may be highly political because it's challenging, you know, the status quo in, you know, what has previously been considered acceptable art. It's challenging the status quo in the idea of a kind of, you know, simple mental model. It's bringing out all of our subconscious, all that kind of thing. So I think you have to have a kind of a sort of nuanced idea of what political art can be. And I also think, you know, I don't judge art by the politics of the creator. You know, plenty of my very, very favorite books are by people whose politics I disagree with profoundly. And I know that there are people that like my books who would not agree with a word I say politically. And I think that's very important, because if you want to write political art, then if it's bad art, it's bad politics. So you have to start as a writer or as an artist by saying, you know, I want to create the best art I can do. And if I also want to put some politics in there, that's fine. But if it fails as art, then it's ipso facto going to fail as politics. All of which said, Iron Council is a fairly obviously and overtly political book because I really wanted to do one. I really wanted to write one political book that was very overt in dealing with political themes. And I may do more, I don't know. But this was a story that develops out of political ideas, and I'd really, really wanted to do it. But it's not a work of agitprop. You know, if I want to try and convince somebody of something political, I'll write an article or I'll have a debate with them. What I want to do in this book is write a really exciting, enthralling novel. But yes, it happens to be a novel with a lot of politics in it, and without the politics, it wouldn't be a novel.
You talk about the forms of war in this book quite a bit. War as disasters, attack from without, attack from within. and attacks that may not actually be attacks.
Mm.
Could you tell us a little bit about your thoughts as you were developing these different concepts?
Well, mostly I was interested in the way war often kind of bleeds into upheaval internally. I mean, you look at the First World War, for example, you know, in the first year or two of the First World War, there's a huge upsurge of kind of nationalism and jingoism, and everyone's, you know, rah-rah for the war. And then within like 2 years, you're talking about the war without has very precisely become the war within. And in places like Russia, you know, in a very, you know, overt way, much of that fervor has become sort of, you know, sort of rechanneled into a kind of insurrection. But across Europe, you know, you had, you know, huge social upheaval, huge sort of, you know, radical questioning of the wisdom of the day that came directly out of that kind of external war. So I think I was very interested in the way, and, you know, to a certain extent, you see the same thing here. I mean, you see, you know, what's been going on with Iraq, you know, all of the, you know, many people who were very sure about the war in the early days, they haven't lost any of their fervor, but it's taken a very different direction. And they're now very unsure about the war, quite rightly, in my opinion. So I was interested in the way, you know, war, as you say, has very many levels. And one of the levels is that it bleeds quite directly into, you know, at the most extreme, civil war. But at the very least, a kind of questioning, a social upheaval. War is very destabilizing at all levels. And, you know, unfortunately for those that want to wage war, war externally doesn't have a hard membrane with war internally. And it kind of, you know, the backwash of war is social upheaval. And that happens throughout history.
One of the things you do well in this and all your novels is to deploy technology and deploy magic as technology. You seem to just have fun with it in every novel, and it's really fun for the readers see what you're going to do with each time. Could you talk about that both across the scope of your novels, really?
Well, my main issue is to try and make the technology plausible. I mean, it doesn't have to be realistic, and in fact it's wildly unrealistic, but it does have to be plausible. And one of the things that I like doing is weird science. So magic in my world is a science, but it's a very weird science, you know. And I like, in each of the three books set in Bas-Lag, I've taken a different kind of subfield of weird science and used it quite a lot in the book. So that in the first book, it's what was called crisis energy. In the second book, it's what was called possibility mining, which is vaguely related to quantum theory. And in the third book, in this book, what I call somatogy, which is golems, the creation of golems. And in each case, I just really like the shape of this weird science. I just like inventing, you know, kooky, mad stuff that, you know, for each of these techniques. I also like treating them seriously as if they were sciences, so that they can't just be used to do anything. They have rigorous rules, just like physics and biology and chemistry, but they happen to be different rules. But, you know, but the people that use these techniques in the books are scientists. They're just different kinds of scientists. And the third thing is that with magic and weird science, what you can do is you can examine metaphors of human behavior and the social world. So with crisis energy, partly I was interested in questions of social tension and social crisis, and I kind of literalized that into the depiction of this particular kind of energy. And with golems, I was interested in the idea of human intervention in the world, and the golem, the kind of artificial person, as a sort of a very vivid metaphor for that. So I wanted to kind of explore that.
Your novels also have a great interest in the media that I find really fascinating. And the media is always very low-tech, but it's very effective.
Well, there's a big this is partly because of the research in kind of Victoriana that I did for the books, you know, and there's a big tradition in, you know, the kind of the underground newspaper, the development of the newspaper is something that interests me a lot, you know, and also kind of alternative media, like the way gangs and political people use graffiti as a way of passing messages to each other, or hand signals or that kind of thing. So I'm interested in, you know, in those, you know, the media as a disseminator of information, both for for truth and lies, and in its various forms. Yeah. But you're right, it's not really a mass media. I mean, the closest it gets is the newspaper, which are very, very important in these books. The newspapers are highly important. But there's no internet, there's no cable TV in New Crobuzon yet.
Not yet. Could you tell us what to expect from you in your next novel? Have you started it yet?
I have started it. And I'm going to be very superstitious and not really say much about it, because I don't like talking about books that aren't... talking about things that aren't yet written seems to me like just asking for a disaster. So, but what I will say is that for this book, and probably the next one as well, I'm moving away from New Crobuzon. They're not set in Baslag, because I want to kind of create a bit of a buffer. Perdido Street Station, The Scar, and Iron Council work together. They are, they're standalones, but they do relate to each other. And I wanted to kind of stop there for a bit. And I'll probably come back to New Crobuzon and Baslag in two or three novels' time. So the next one or two will be very different.
Oh, well, that sounds interesting. We've been speaking with China Mieville. His latest novel is Iron Council. Thanks for talking, China.
Thanks for having me on.